I'm pulling in my driveway. We all know what that means. It's time to have to drive to work. Okay, so today's topic is on something that I don't even know the name of. I'm just calling it the rule. So in Magic, we have a rule that says all cards, and this is in Black Border. Unsets work a little differently. We'll get to that. But in Black Border, all cards with the same English name have to function mechanically identically. Meaning it doesn't matter what version you play of a card. It doesn't matter what set it comes from, what art's on it. Like, none, it doesn't matter the version you have, that all cards with the same name function identically. Now, interestingly, this rule did not always exist. So we're going to talk a little bit about where the rule came from, why we have the rule, and just talk a bit about sort of, it's a history lesson, actually, about the evolution of Magic and the need for the rule. So that's today's topic, is more than you possibly wanted to know about the rule, the thing that it's, the unnamed thing that I'm now explaining right now. So let's begin our story all the way back in Alpha. So Magic is a card game, which means we have to print the cards. And early on, so when Wizards of the Coast, when Richard Garfield first came to pitch, not even Magic, he was pitching Robo Rally, and they were a tiny company, and they're like, we don't have the resources to make a game with lots of pieces. And Richard said, what can you make? And they said, well, we have a printer, we can make cards, and we have access to artists, we can have cards with pretty pictures on them. And so Richard set off to make a game to be played in between Dungeons & Dragons games, which is what, you know, he made Magic. So when Alpha came out, there were a lot of mistakes on the sheets. And mostly, like, they'd just never done this before. This was a company sort of, like, Magic as a product is a pretty complex product, especially when you take into account that it hadn't been made before. Like, it's not like, you know, if you're going to make a trading card game now, well, you can look at other trading card games. But this was them. I mean, they had trading cards to look at, so they had a little bit of things to work with. But the idea essentially was they were doing it for the first time. And early Magic was plagued with lots of printing issues. And it varied from set to set. I'm going to go through Alpha in a second. But like Arabian Nights, some of the cards were darker than they were supposed to be. So there's like two versions of certain cards. Antiquities repeated, you could get the same card twice in your 8-card pack. Legends, the uncommons were split into two sections, A and B. I think they might have been on two separate sheets. And a box either had all of one or all of the other. So if you got a box of Legends, you only got half of the uncommons. So there were a lot of printing things early on. Alpha specifically had a lot of misprints. So let's walk through exactly what they... So there are a bunch of different kinds of misprints. First up is what I will call, there's some just editing issues. For example, Doug Schuler, one of the artists who did Sarah Angel, his name is spelled wrong in the entire set. There is a bunch of cards, there's a bunch of cards that have the word discard in them, and the word card is all capitalized. I assume they were using card for card name or something. There are some cards that are supposed to reference mana symbols, but reference letters instead. Like on Force of Nature, it's supposed to cost you green, 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 but the card says G, 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 G. And then there was like a bunch of artists were just mislabeled. Like COP Red says it's done by Anson Maddox, but it's actually done by Mark Tadine. Central says it's done by Jeff Mengus, but it's actually Dan Frazier. Tropical Island says Mark Poole, but it was Jesper Mirforce. So there's a bunch of that. Probably the real important misprints, the ones that matter for gameplay, was there was a misprint where the card is just not correctly explaining what it is. For example, Cyclopean Tomb was supposed to cost 4 generic mana. It's just missing a mana symbol. Elvish Archers was a green rare. It was supposed to be a 2/1 first strike creature, but it was printed as a 1/2 creature. Orcish Oriflamme and Orcish Artillery. So Orcish Artillery was supposed to cost 1 red for a 2/3 that you could tap it to do 2 damage to any... 2 damage to any creature and 3 damage to you, the player, I think. Oh, no. Or did it damage to... Yeah, I think it damaged to you, the player. And that was supposed to be 1RR, and it was 1R. Orcish Aura Flame, which gave all your creatures +1/+0, was supposed to be 3 and a red, and instead was 1 and a red. Red Elemental Blast, which was supposed to be an interrupt, was mislabeled as an instant. Ironically, that would later become true, but at the time it was... So there are a bunch of things like that where the card is literally isn't saying... It's technically wrong that it's saying something about the card that isn't true. Or in the case of Cyclone and Doom, just missing something that you need. There actually was one more category. I'll use Island Sanctuary as my example here. So Island Sanctuary... So the idea of Island Sanctuary is you are on an island. So creatures can't harm you unless they have flying or island walk, right? Unless they can get to the island, you're safe from them. But the way it was worded, it said you may not take damage from any creature that doesn't have flying or island walk. Well, remember Orcish Artillery, the one that did damage to you? You did 2 damage to any target and did 3 damage to you? Well, it doesn't have flying or island walk. So the Alpha Island Sanctuary would protect you from your own Orcish Artillery. Now, the idea there, that wasn't the intent. The intent of the card was the opponents, but there are some examples where we wrote things and didn't quite write them in the cleanest way possible. So when Beta came along, they fixed things. The sheet left off Circle of Protection Black and Volcanic Island. We're just left off the Alpha sheet. They showed up in Beta. So Beta... They changed some things around. They corrected a bunch of their mistakes. They cleaned some things up. Things like Island Sanctuary, I believe, changes. I believe the Beta Island Sanctuary is different in text than the Alpha Island Sanctuary. So suffice to say, there were just cards that were different. Now, in early Magic, the way the rules worked was you played the card as it read, meaning you cared about the actual version you had. So, I remember there were people who, like, had decks with Alpha Orcish Artilleries, because they only cost 1R, and Alpha Island Sanctuaries, because it protects you from damage from it. And the idea is, if you wanted to play that deck, you needed the Alpha Island Sanctuary, because that's no other Island Sanctuary worked that way. And if you wanted the cheaper Orcish Artillery, you needed the Alpha Orcish Artillery. Now, you could play with the Beta, but that costs 1 red, so it costs more mana. But that was the idea in early on, and it's pretty simple to explain why that was the case. And I've talked about this a lot, but it's important for this lesson today. When Richard made Magic, he made it to be a normal game, a game you would buy in the game store and probably play at home with your friends. You can't imagine Magic becoming what it did. That's not the kind of thing you plan for. It's an awesome thing to happen. But the idea essentially was, you know, and remember, when Magic first came out, the internet was in its infancy. The World Wide Web didn't exist yet, I believe. So, like, looking things up was not easy. And people didn't have cell phones, or at least not cell phones that you could look up information on. So early on, the idea was Richard wanted to make sure that you were aided by the game pieces. And so the easiest way to understand what's going on is, well, read the piece. Your card says what it does. And if cards were slightly different, well, that's okay. Just, you know, read the actual physical card you have. Early Magic, that made a lot of sense. In the sense that, in my house with my friends, this card, well, that's how it functions. That's what it says. And the idea that the card should match what the card says was super important. And the other thing is, early on in Magic, when we would reprint cards, we would take that as an opportunity to clean up things. Even things in which, well, technically this is slightly different. Like Castle, the Alpha Castle, I think gives you +0/+2 if you're not tapped, and I think the later castle is, like, attacking creatures that aren't tapped, or, like, it slightly tweaks what it is. And the idea at the time was, early Magic had such small print runs that when we were doing, like, we're reprinting cards into later core sets, most people who will play the game will have this later set. So we would actually change cards a little bit to clean things up. Like, oh, well, this is not how we templated originally, but this is what we meant. And the idea originally was, okay, well, you know, as we print later cards, most of the people who have later cards, we'll fix it in later cards. But eventually we started running into trouble. And so I often talk about, myself, along with Bill Rose, Mike Elliott, William Jockish, and Henry Stern are sort of what I call the second age of R&D. The first age were people that were part of the playtest team, although technically Bill was part of the playtest team, who came to work at Wizards and, you know, this was Scaff, Elias, Jim Lynn, Dave Petty, Richard, obviously. And a lot of these people had done early designs and, you know, were helping getting the game off the ground. But there came a point where Magic, you know, had matured a little bit. It was like 2 years into Magic. And they were interested in doing other things. Richard wanted to make other trading card games and other games. And mostly Wizards was growing as a company. And they wanted to do other stuff. So they hired the five of us, basically, to sort of be in charge of running Magic. It's not that they never got involved in Magic. They did. They peeked their head in from time to time. But as far as the day-to-day, like, the development teams at the time were the five of us. I mean, Henry didn't start till a year after the rest of us. But we were the development team. It wasn't like there was different development teams. Every development team was the four of us. Me, Bill, Mike, and William. And then eventually when Henry joined Henry. And one of the things that I think started happening that us became very aware of is that when the game is just a small game that's played in people's houses, it's okay that cards work differently. It's okay that the card at my house and the card at your house don't work the same. You might not even be aware that's true. But once the game started shifting where, hey, I might go to a game store and there's sanctioned play, and I can play a game with something on the line against a stranger that I've never met before, that's just a very different thing. And so what we spent a lot of time on early on was consolidation and continuity. That early Magic, when it was, like, one of the things that I want to stress, none of this is a knock against Richard. Richard designed the game for what he intended the game to be and what he thought the game was, what the game most likely would have been. But Magic kind of did things that no one expected. And, like, early on, so Richard, the game that probably influenced Magic the Gathering the most was a game called Cosmic Encounter. So Cosmic Encounter, really briefly, for those that have never played, you take the role of an alien, and you're sort of conquering the universe. You're taking over parts of the universe. You're fighting over planets. And the way that a lot of this stuff happens is, the way conflict happens, is you have cards. And a lot of times when you're challenging somebody, you're flipping up cards. But a couple things. One, there are cards that change the nature of how things work. So the game has rules, but there are cards in the game that change the rules, that you break the rules of the game. And each alien has a special power. And so each alien has a rule unique to themselves. And so as you're playing the game, each time you're a different alien, and the aliens play differently because there's the way they interact with the game is slightly different, because usually they inherently break a rule or get some special ability that the other aliens don't. And you have cards that break the rules. And so a lot of time what happens, which Richard really enjoyed, is you get interactions you'd never seen before. Oh, I'm this alien, and you're that alien, and I have this card, and you have that card. Oh, I've never encountered this mix of things before. What will happen? And what Richard really enjoyed, and this is fun if most of you are playing with you and your friends, is let us figure out what's going to happen. And that we're going to have a debate and talk through things, and that there was a lot of fun to Richard in, like, part of playing the game is finding these weird things that happen, and then sometimes you, the players, have to figure out what's going to go on. And that is a lot of fun. When you are at home with your friends and your play group, that can be very fun. But if you're at a tournament with something on the line, playing a stranger, it's not great to have to argue with the stranger about how the rules work when each one of you has a really strong incentive for it to work a certain way. And so we realized we needed to start consolidating things. For example, and I've talked about this, a lot of the evolution of magic is us pulling back about how much we care about things. In early designs, like the rules, were very much designed on a card-by-card basis. In fact, so Tom Wiley, who was the original rules manager, he needed to write an article in the Duelist, the magazine we had once upon a time, to show how batches worked. Before there was the stack, there was things called batches, and they were a little complicated. So Tom was writing a flow chart to show you how it worked. And to demonstrate a little, making a little commentary on the rule system, he made it look like a rat maze because it was that complicated. And so a lot of what we wanted to do early on was we wanted to create continuity. So Bill, for example, took it upon himself to really clean up the rules. I mean, he worked with other people, obviously, but there was the 6th edition rules, and that introduced the stack. It got rid of interrupts. It just did a lot of things to clean up and streamline the rules. And the idea was we wanted the players to learn the rules, and once you learn the rules, all the new cards followed the rules you knew, and that it just made it easier to understand how things work. And there weren't exceptions. The editors, Del, for example, Del Lago, the editors at the time, Del starts like in 99, I think. But anyway, early on, the editors took upon themselves to start figuring out sort of consistent templating. One of the challenges of early Magic is you'd have two cards that kind of did the same thing, but they wouldn't have the same words on it. So another thing of consolidating is we want all the things that do the same things to have the same words, that we want things to be clean and clear. And that when we reprinted cards, well, we stopped doing sort of what we call functional errata. We didn't make them work differently. We did change their template. We did make sure that they wanted to play as clean as they could. And then I took it upon myself to really start cleaning up the color pie. Early Magic was kind of all over the board, you know. And I'm like, look, I want colors to have strengths and weaknesses. That if we aren't consistent with it, you know, if green's weakness is this, but then we make a card that undoes green's weakness, well, is that green's weakness? You know, and so there's a lot of that sort of second wave of R&D. A lot of what we were doing was starting to consolidate the game, making the game consistent. Make sure that if you understood how something worked in one place, it worked the same in the other place. And as you started to learn things, there was continuity between them. Okay, which gets us to the rule. Now, I did a little research on, I was trying to figure out when Oracle started. Oracle was, so I do know, so in 2002, we started Magic Online. Magic Online was the first digital implication of Magic, or the first time we did digital Magic. Magic Arena will come later. And in order for us to do that, we needed the computer had to have continuity. If two cards worked the same, the computer had to treat them the same. And so I know we were doing early work. So the game came out in 2002, but we were probably working on it in the late 90s, starting to figure out how to make it work, how to make digital Magic work. And that one of the keys to digital Magic working was the idea that if you and I had the same card, obviously online it had to work the same. And so we realized that as we changed things, as we updated templates, we needed some way to just make what's the latest version of everything. And we had a database, we called it The Gathering. And so we invented Oracle. And Oracle says, this is the most up-to-date wording for every card in existence. And the reason the Oracle was important was it created a sense of continuity. It allowed digital to have a straight through line and everything. And so my best guess is I think Oracle's creation, I mean, I'm not sure the chicken and the egg. I'm not sure if digital made us make Oracle or we made Oracle, which allowed us to then start to pursue digital. I'm not quite sure the order of those things happen. But anyway, we create Oracle. And once we create Oracle, once we can say, okay, there's a definitive answer for what the latest template is, that's when the rule got made. And the idea is, okay, there exists, and at this point, the other thing is the internet had evolved a bit. The World Wide Web happened, and I mean, now we could have a website and, you know, there are cell phones, and like, now you could start to check things. Although we're talking, I guess, the internet existed, you could look things up. Maybe cell phones weren't quite a thing just yet. Cell phones are slightly later. or cell phones that you could look things up. Cell phones existed, I guess, but not cell phones you could like search the internet on yet. That's coming. That's really, you need to get stuff like the iPhones. So anyway, we make this rule and we say, if you're playing a card, no matter what version of the card you're playing, it doesn't matter what printing. Was it the alpha printing? Was it, you know, fourth edition? Was it seventh edition? Was it reprinted in an expansion? Whatever. Those are the same. That if a card has the same name, it's the same. And what does it do? Ah, it does what Oracle says it does. And that beget a lot of rules. That's when we started saying we didn't want to do errata, what we call functional errata, which is we were very careful about changing how a card worked. I'm not saying we never do. We do occasionally when we have to. But we're very careful about when and how we do functional errata. Now, I will say, when we made this rule, we came up with a small problem. And the poster child of this problem is a card called City in a Bottle. So City in a Bottle was a card from Arabian Nights. So in fact, Richard Garfield... So the story of Arabian Nights is Magic comes out. Magic is planned to be out for like a year. Like, there was... Richard had the people start to work on expansions. But the idea was the expansions would be a year in, 2 years in. No one... Once again, Magic... for those who don't know the story, is Wizard of the Coast prints enough for what they think is going to be a year supply, or 6 months to a year supply, and it gets sold in 3 weeks. Then they make beta, and way, way more. They make a whole bunch more. They make beta, which is significantly more than alpha. And they're like, okay, this time we mean it. This is going to be a year supply, and it goes in a week. And then eventually they get unlimited. But Magic was doing so well that Peter came to Richard and said, we need to make an expansion. So Richard very quickly made an expansion. And he made it based... There's a comic called Sandman. And Sandman number 50, which I think is called City in a Bottle. I think that's the name. Has a story that has a Persian flavor to it. And so Richard really became enamored with taking the book 1001 Arabian Nights, which is a collection of sort of Persian Arabian stories, and turning that into a set, being inspired by that. Some could argue the first universe is beyond. Richard made it. It was not a lot of cards. It was like 78 cards, I believe. It was not a lot of cards. It got sold in eight card boosters. But it was something to put out. Because Richard wasn't quite sure about how people were going to interact with the expansion. Like, originally, by the way, Arabian Nights was going to have a different back, a pink back. And Scaff, I think, talked Richard out of it at the very, like, the right before it was going to go into print. And they realized they wanted continuity between the sets. But anyway... Because Richard didn't know how people would respond, he made a card called City in a Bottle, which, I think the episode 50 was called City in a Bottle, I believe. And what City in a Bottle did was it got rid of, if you activated it, it was kind of like Neverall's Disc, except it only destroyed cards from the Arabian Nights expansion. And I think at the time he just said, oh, destroy any card with an Arabian Nights expansion symbol on it. Now, when we got to the rule, we ran into this problem. There are cards that were in Arabian Nights that were later in 3rd edition or 4th edition. And in 3rd or 4th edition, they didn't have an Arabian Nights expansion symbol. So, for example, because the set was originally going to have different backs, they put all the basic lands in it. When they, at the last minute, decided not to do that, they removed the basic lands from the sheets, except they missed one. There's a mountain. So there is a mountain with an Arabian Nights expansion symbol on it. And people used to like to play with the mountain because it was very rare. It was a way to show off. But if your opponent had City in a Bottle and you had that mountain, it would get destroyed by City in a Bottle. And so, for example, now normal mountain was slightly different mechanically from Arabian Nights mountain because Arabian Nights mountain got destroyed by City in a Bottle. And so we got this first contradiction. Well, if we're saying that every card is mechanically the same, we can't say, well, cards interact with it differently. And so they ended up changing City in a Bottle. The way it's now worded is, it says all cards that originated in Arabian Nights, and then it lists the cards. So it doesn't count Mountain. The Oracle version basically says, I will destroy the following cards, and there's a long list of cards. It doesn't define it by B effect. Maybe it doesn't even say first printed in Arabian Nights. Because all it says is, destroy the following cards, and it just lists the cards that so happen were the cards in Arabian Nights. We now realize, there's things that are on cards that change from printings. A card, for example, might have an expansion symbol, but get reprinted and have a different expansion symbol. It might be one rarity, but get reprinted, be a different rarity. It might have one artist, but then have a different artist, have a different collector number. Maybe it has a watermark. All of a sudden, there are some qualities that we are no longer allowed to mechanically care about, because the rule says we need things to be the same. That it's important that no matter what you do, you know how the card functions. That it's not like I'm playing against my opponent and go, what version of the card do you have? Oh, that's the Arabian Night version? You're like, that was just too much. And so now, the unsets picked up. One of the things that the unsets like to do is, where is there a fun design space that Black Border can't do? And one of it was caring about these things. It's fun to care about rarity or expansion symbol or artists or watermarks. And so unsets can and do that. One of the differences is sort of the golden rule of unplay. When you're playing with uncards, it in fact does look at the actual card you're playing. So if there's a card in an unset that wants you to count the number of lines of text, you don't look up the oracle, you just look at the card you're playing. That whenever the cards care about qualities of a card, in Unworld, you have to look at the actual card you're playing. And the idea is, Unworld is not normal tournament magic. You're not going to show up and play a stranger at a store with something on the line in an unset. So that's where we sort of allow that to live. So sort of Richard's original vision does live on uncard. So we are, if you want to care about things like watermarks or rarity or whatever, we can. There are cards that do that in the unsets. So the rule got created, and we've been pretty consistent about it. In fact, the reason this whole podcast came about is one of the questions I keep getting asked is, can you take some of the cards from unsets that now work in the rules, Die Rolling being the easiest? When I first, like when Unglued came out, like there's a card in Unglued called Elvish Impersonator. And what you do is you roll two dice, and the first die is its power, and the second die is its toughness. So this is a variable card. It can be anything from a 1-1 up to a 6-6. It's kind of a fun card. Early on, die rolling wasn't a thing in Black Border. So if you wanted to play the card, it had to be silver bordered. There was no die rolling. But then along came the first Dungeon Dragon set, which had die rolling. Now, it rolled D20s, but D6s do work within the rules. And so the idea is people are like, hey, I want to play Elvish Impersonator. Can you just print a Black Border Elvish Impersonator? And the trouble, this is where this came about, is there are two rules right now. One rule says that all cards with the same English name can be played, as long as they're real cards. There are cards that have different backs and things like Pro Tour decks, or there's different things we've made with the gold borders and different backs. But those aren't actual Magic cards in the sense that they're not, you know, they don't have normal backs. Uncards have normal backs on them. There's a rule that says all cards with the same English name function the same. There's another rule that says if you have a silver border, now an acorn, you're not playable in tournaments. So if we made a black border card of something that existed in silver border, we had this weird situation where, can I play the silver border card? If I follow the rule that says all cards with the same name function the same, I can. But if I follow the rule that says all silver border cards are not tournament legal, I can't. And the two rules contradict each other. And up to now, it's never been an issue. But it's something that people are asking for, and I'm explaining we have to solve that issue. That's where this whole topic came up from. But one of the reasons I wanted to do it today, the reason I wanted to do this podcast, is that a lot of the evolution of Magic, a lot of the history of Magic design, is us having to adapt the game to the needs of the game, to the needs of the audience. That Richard made the game to function in a certain way, which was great, but when the game started functioning a little bit differently, the game had to adapt to the environment it was in. And by the way, that is true throughout the history of Magic. When Commander started becoming a thing, the game had to adapt to Commander. As different things happen, the game has to adapt. That the players like things and want things, and so the game adapts to the needs and wants of the players, and so we keep shifting. And that's just an ongoing thing. I'm talking today a lot about the need for continuity, but that's just early Magic. That's just early Magic was not built to be, you know, early Magic was made that cards could be different from one another, even if they had the same name. And we realized there came a point where that just, that didn't make sense in the world we were living in. And so we had to change it. But anyway, guys, I hope you enjoyed. I have fun doing these podcasts to sort of dig a little into the history and the philosophy of the history. Like, one of the neat things to me as I look back is looking at why and how things changed. That it is kind of cool that, you know, it's just kind of cool that Magic itself, like, you know, this is my 31st year working on Magic, and I get people all the time, like, aren't you tired of working on Magic? I'm like, no. Magic sort of keeps evolving, keeps changing. And part of it is every set has different challenges for design. But another part of it is the game itself keeps evolving. And that's one of the things that's really neat and exciting to me. And so, anyway, that, my friends, is the history of the rule, which still exists. Will we ever solve the black-bordered un thing? I'll try to solve that. But anyway, I hope you guys enjoyed this little peek into history. But I'm at work, so you all know what that means. This is the end of my drive to work. So instead of talking magic, it's time for me to be making magic. See you next time. Bye-bye.